Members, I'm going to call this meeting of the Energy Policy Committee to order. Our testifier today is from MISO, and she is stuck in a snowbank in Eagan. She has just been dislodged from the snowbank in Eagan and is on her way to the Capitol. But what I suggest that we do for out of respect to members' time is that we recess and reconvene at 1 o'clock. Any questions or comments? If not, the committee is in recess.
I know.
Figured if anybody didn't have a chance.
I'm going to go grab my stick.
Yeah, you are.
Yep, you're here.
Okay.
If it's really exciting,
I'll take it.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. You've been unregulated. All right. How's it going, Bob?
Okay.
I just know I'm about 17% covered for about 27 bills in the last 4 days. And do you guys have a system where you can offload when you have too much?
Well,
the advisor.
Yeah.
Can you call Ryan and say,
You can make an assessment of
which ones you have.
Peter?
I'm sorry, but
thank you.
those are different pieces of the same bill?
The different initiatives throughout. At least going back behind it.
Yeah, Well, they'll turn less from whatever the most expensive source is. And, you know, it's also not preventing them lengthening the time when they'll have to go to the shut down a plant earlier than the other ones.
Well, we have
Oh, no, it's got renewed for 20 years.
Well, the renewal is, I'm talking about the equipment.
Oh. Well, I think they, they're kind of upgrading.
So that's what's been wondering, how many of these things are going to be best for our region. Coming into the region.
Well, yeah,
I don't either. Marshall is sick. got to sell that.
They heard.
Okay.
And he's like, well, what? I was like, you weren't here, so we had to recess the meeting. I'm like, nah, joke.
Who's there?
I was goofing around with Michael.
Oh.
Because he comes in.
I'm so sorry. I'm the only one in town. No. We already did.
Chasing people out of the room again, huh? Thanks, boss.
That's our job.
Who's in the snowbank? Who was in the snowbank? Oh,
Miss White.
Okay, Mr. Gatekeeper, all right. What?
Members, we're reconvening the Energy Policy Committee here at about 1:05, and I think everybody who hadn't had a chance to eat lunch before had a chance to eat lunch. So we're going to go ahead with our presentation from the Midwest Independent Transmission System Operator. When we had the Department of Commerce here and the Public Utilities Commission here earlier in the session, I got a lot of advice from people that we should have MISO come and testify. to help us kind of understand the system a little bit better. And Mariah White kindly agreed to come give us an overview of MISO. And we will let her complete her presentation, and then we'll do member questions. So, Ms. White, thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. And everybody in the audience, first of all, please allow me to sincerely apologize for me being late and taking up your time. Yes, as a lot of people asked me, I did get stuck in the snowbank. What happened was I was doing a favor. I'll give you the really abridged version, not to take your time. I was doing a favor for some elderly church members from my church at 10 o'clock this morning, and I picked up what they wanted and took it to their house and got stuck in their driveway. And the elderly gentleman was, of course, going to help me shovel out. Now he's like 75 or 80 years old, so he wanted to shovel, and I said, no, I'll shovel. So we had that little tussle, and we were both shoveling, and I kept saying, no. It just kept sliding further and further, and I said, no, let me get a taxi. Oh, no, we'll get it out. So we had that going on for over an hour. And finally, I just gave up. My car is sitting half in the ladies' flower bed because that's the way their driveway is configured, on a little slope. And I'll worry about calling AAA when we're done here. But I'm very sorry for being so late and taking up your time, and thank you for your indulgence. And with that, thank you very much for the opportunity for us to give you an overview of an entity that you probably really never heard of, and we like to think that that's actually a good thing, because the only time that you ever hear about probably our organization is when the lights aren't working or the electricity goes off or something like that, and then you hear from the utilities with members behind me, and you also hear from us. So we're the us and the utilities and the generators and all of the stakeholders are the multi-billion dollar industry that you never need to worry about. Hopefully that's our goal, is for you never have to worry about us. And with that, I'll begin. The Midwest Independent System Operator, what I did was I wanted to put together a presentation to start at the beginning, because this is an organically grown, not only organization, but an organically grown industry, with roots starting at very, very early in the 20th century, if not the end of the 19th century. The earliest lighting that was common in the United States was gas lighting, and that was about in the 1890s to the beginning of the 20th century. Cities had their own little manufactured gas, little whatever they were. they burnt coal, usually coming off the railroads that were coal-operated. Dropped off coal, and these were the gas lights that you heard about, not only for street lighting, but some of the more affluent houses had gas lights. So that's where we start. This is in the beginning. I just wanted to give you a little bit idea. And then the light bulb was invented, and lights and motors. Electricity was harnessed through lighting and motors and went on in the industry. From about the 1920s and on, communities and cities started building their own little power plants. They had, previously had the manufactured gas plants. They retrofitted them for this new thing called electricity, and that became available to more houses, and they just started growing. Each of the cities had their own little power plants until about the 20s and the 30s. At that point, the federal government started the Rural Electrification Act. Congress enacted that, and that started building transmission lines, power lines to farms and to communities, rural communities, to bring them electricity, and that basically electrified the United States. As the little owners, the utilities of these cities, started realizing that it was a good idea, along with the rural power lines, to start interconnecting their power lines when they got close to each other. There are benefits to both of those entities when they do that because they could electricity could run on all of that and started becoming a spider web of transmission lines all over the place. And the entities found that it was to their benefit to have these spider webs. And that's how today's electric grid has grown organically into the spider web grid that we have today. I just wanted to give you a pictorial on all of the parts, a simplified version of the parts of what makes up the power grid and what supplies electricity to people's houses and this room. Starting with the generation through the big transmission lines. Big transmission lines need to go into substations. You've seen substations around. What they do is they take the strength of power. All the engineers will probably shudder if I say that because it's not technically correct, but it is English versus engineerese. And what they call step it down to a lower power that's more usable in appliances and electronics. That is distributed by the utilities that we have into two customers. This is the next part of the presentation. We'll go on to it's a regional transmission operator and an independent system operator. For the most part, you can use these terms interchangeably, but we'll just talk a little bit about what they are. In 1965, there was a great big blackout in the United States. Congress saw that and knew that something had to be done. They created the National Electric Reliability Corporation, or NERC, that basically oversaw the reliability of the power system, the interstate power system. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission also at that time was prompted to take action, and they issued a number of orders saying that this spiderweb transmission grid that we have benefits interstate commerce and benefits everyone on an interstate basis. So they decided to open up and make the transmission grid open access. Prior to that, whoever owned the transmission line could allow or disallow someone's electrons to flow over that transmission line. Everything was done by contracts between two parties, bilateral contracts. The federal government stepped in and said, no, you have to essentially allow your transmission line to be used by anyone, much like a highway. So that was Order 888, which really fundamentally changed the industry. FERC also issued Order 2000 in late 1999, which also set up not only did they open up the transmission lines in open access, but then they said electricity should be viewed as a commodity and we should have markets set up to allow anyone to buy and sell electricity on this open market. And that's basically what Order 2000 did. These two orders, FERC orders, were very fundamental in really changing the electricity industry. I just will give you the next set of bullets is just the goals of these orders. The benefits that FERC wanted for these orders, and to just to provide an open, transparent means that everybody can see what's going on, market, and to allow electricity to buy and sell and flow through the grid on an open access basis. Regional organizations became entities that FERC created through these orders to facilitate the actual markets, marketing, buying and selling, of electricity, as well as the ensuring that the open access flow of electricity over the grid was maintained. That's the independence of these independent system operators or regional transmission operators. This map is just the list, or shows you the independent system operators that are in existence today. The parts that do not include independent system operators, for example, the Southeast, do not have those organizations. They have reliability, you could call them cooperatives, although they're not a cooperative in a classic sense. But the utilities in the Southeast, for example, get together to maintain reliability in their area. But they're not set up as markets like the independent system operators set up markets. These are not mandated. Independent system operators and RTOs systems are not mandated by the government. They are membership driven, and members can join ISOs and they can leave ISOs, and they do frequently. It's a big deal to do that. It costs a lot of money and a lot of time and effort to do that. But they are free to do it if they feel like they would be in a better position if they did the change. Now, what is MISO? Midwest Independent Transmission System Operator. We are an independent nonprofit, and our basic goal and mission in life is the safe, cost-effective delivery of power to customers. We have three primary roles. First one is basically to operate the grid, reliability. Next is to operate the energy markets that we have, and I'll talk a little bit about the markets. Basically just to facilitate the open purchase and sale of power. And then we do a lot of transmission planning. When you're thinking about the possibility of using people's lands for power lines, which, as you know, is not a popular thing, as well as spending what could be billions of dollars, you need to do a lot of planning and a lot of contingency planning to make sure that the decisions you're making are the best decisions, and can accommodate a number of situations in the future. I provide this slide just for your information. There are a number of slides in here that are just for your information. Basically, we don't need to talk about. This is basically a timeline of the FERC orders that I mentioned, plus some other big FERC orders, and the timeline of the creation of MISO. So you can see how the creation of MISO kind of either reacts or melds with the FERC orders. MISO is FERC regulated, so our actions reflect FERC orders and obligations. Here's MISO's footprint, and when I say footprint, it's just our service area. We have two of them, basically. We'll look at the one on the right. The reliability footprint is the operating the grid footprint. And we include a larger area there because we are the reliability organization and operate the grid or with all of the entities, including the province of Manitoba, all the way down now to the Gulf of Mexico through Entergy, which is a very, very large, that's the dark blue in the colored, if you can see it, slide. But that's from Arkansas down to Louisiana. Is Entergy companies, the big utilities that are now in the process of joining MISO. So that's just operating grid. So we're through the entire section of the United States into Canada. The market part looks more at, these are the members, mostly the members or cooperative partners that we have that buy and sell in the MISO market, buy and sell power in the MISO market. So we have basically one footprint, but there are, if you're looking at reliability or if you're looking at the buy and sell market, there's slight differences. I wanted to give you a little bit about the functions of MISO, a little bit more. This is the reliability part of it, the first of the three major functions. We monitor the grid always, 24/7, 365. It's all our operations control centers are always manned. We have massive computing power, 333,000 data points every 5 seconds are gathered just to make sure that everything, the energy is flowing on the grid, all of the equipment is working, so we don't anticipate seeing anything, any issues. We also, not only that, but computers run 8,300 contingencies every 4 minutes. And what that is we monitor every generation point, every substation, every transmission line segment, just to see to make sure that everything is operating, and just to give us an idea of if something goes down, if something comes off, what can happen, how can we redirect flows of power, just so we're always on guard with the operations. We are obligated by NERC and FERC to document everything that we do. We are audited. In fact, we just got done with a very large NERC audit throughout the entire month of November. We came off fine. To show that we document everything that we do. We also coordinate with all of our partners to ensure that reliability from their territory to our territory continues seamlessly. Second function is the markets. We look at the title kind of says it all. Best cost wholesale energy, and let me talk about that. Best cost may not be lowest cost. Lowest cost could be if you look at what you need in the next year, the next 12 months, and you get that at the lowest cost. If you look out 5 years and you have to repeat that five times, you might not end up over the 5 years with what could have been the lowest cost for the whole 5 years. So what we do is we do planning over short time periods and long time periods and see what works best and what best accommodates what we see as in a number of situations. This especially is true when it comes to building transmission lines, because it may be the lowest cost to build a 115 smaller transmission line. That might be your lowest cost option, but may only cover the issues that you've got for 5 years. So if you're looking out 10 years, you may have to build another 115 line. Well, what that does is instead of taking 100 feet of right-of-way, or maybe 150 feet of right-of-way for a larger transmission line, you might have to take 200 or 300 feet if you want to build more than one transmission line. So we're very cognizant of having to use people's lands for building, and we would rather build a bit bigger transmission line sooner that we know will only have to impact people once, and we won't have to build again very close to or right beside it, or rebuild in the near future. So that's one of the reasons why we call it the best cost or the most efficient cost instead of the lowest cost. The markets that we're talking about here, that's where we look at the lowest cost set of generators. What we do is we set up for our markets is all of the generators that are on our market provide us with a cost of generation They decide their cost of generation that they want to sell it for, and they give us that information. We stack up all the costs from least expensive to most expensive, from least available, like baseload plants, to only plants on certain, they're only available certain time periods. And then we start offering all of that into the market for sale. And the sellers or the buyers come and they buy whatever they wish. They usually go for the lowest cost to match what they need, and the market, that's the way the market operates, basically. We operate a real-time and a day-ahead market. Basically what that means is the day before the energy is used, the buyers and sellers get together and they reserve the energy, they offer the energy that they want to sell, and they reserve the energy that they want to buy for that next day. 95% of the transactions are done in the day-ahead market. They pretty much know, everyone has very good weather models, as good as you can have, and they know their customer base, and they have a pretty good handle on how much energy they'll need the day ahead. For the real-time market, this is their true-up market. This happens right at the real-time. If the weather changes drastically or something happens with their customer base that was unforeseen, this is where they can true up their market to make sure that they can get the power for their customers. Our planning, we look at planning for not only new construction, but we also look at, as an adjunct to that, after we do that, we look at cost allocation. Basically, we look at the entities who either cause the costs, cause the need to build, or benefit from the building, should pay for part of the costs. And there's lots of rules and processes and procedures and policies that go into this, and they are all approved by FERC. We do and have for many years included public policies. For example, Minnesota's RES has been included in our planning since the inception of the planning. So we do actively take into account states' public policies in our planning. I just put this slide in just so you can see. You may at one time or another run into the term our top-down and bottom-up planning. Our members, our utilities, our transmission owners do their own planning for their own customers and their own systems. They know it better than anyone. They do their own specific planning. That's really called bottom-up planning. So it's more micro planning for their system. Then they give us that information. We take all of the members' planning and we look at it from a footprint-wide aspect. And the benefit of that is we can do more efficient planning for multi-members' needs if we look at it on a big footprint planning, and that's the top-down part of it. And then we match the bottom-up planning to the top-down planning. And we look at it from two different ways to make sure that the planning and the projects that come out of that planning not only take care of each of the members, but are most efficient from a footprint-wide. This is basically the transmission expansion plan is done annually. And this is basically projects. This is actually the projects that you will see ultimately are might well see logically built in the future. Many of them are just small projects, upgrading substations, putting in equipment, things like that. But they're also can be very large projects. The CapEx projects, for example, went through this process. And this goes through the top-down and the bottom-up processes. These six boxes are the goals and what is kept in mind as MTEP goes through its process. Many people have said, okay, MISO talks a good game, do they really have add value to this whole process? And that's a very legitimate question. We do a lot of stuff, but is the stuff worth the cost that we entail? So we had an outside entity put together this calculation, which we do every year, and the outside entity actually audits it. It's called our value proposition. What we do is we look at each of these line items, and we look at what it would cost our members to do on their own versus what we can do for them as a service. And you will see there's a whole number of different things. There is 9 categories, as you see, and then we take off the costs of our operation. That's the 10th column. And we come up with a net positive benefit from year to year of about $2 billion a year to customers. I wanted to just give you a little bit about the current major actions that we have going on right now. This is FERC Order 1000. This is another landmark order that's been happening in the last 18 to 24 months. What it did was it took Order 890, which was earlier, and on next slide we'll show you basically what Order 890 did. And it clarifies a number of items and strengthens a number of items. One of the things it does strengthen is it orders all RTOs and ISOs to include public policy and planning. MISO's been doing this since the inception of public policy, but the other RTOs have not. So this basically orders the other RTOs to include public policies. It's a whole number of different things like that. The focus of Order 1000 was to just ensure that policies were more inclusive, like public policies, transmission planning was more all-encompassing, and it also addressed cost allocations. And it applies to all RTOs, ISOs. This goes back to Order 890. And what was done with that. And Order 1000 basically goes through all of these entities and shores them up. MISO has filed two large filings so far, as have all of the other RTOs and ISOs who are subject to this order. Our October filing, we talked about our multi-value, as you see in the first bullet, and market efficiency projects. Those have to do with categories of projects that we have. They're FERC approved. They're in our tariff, and we introduced more information for those. We also baseline in the next bullet with baseline reliability projects. We add, this has to do with cost allocations of these. What we had earlier was for baseline reliability projects, which is just what it says, for projects that ensure reliability, we had had under certain circumstances there in our tariff spread the costs out among more than farther than the local area, and the MISO's order, the way we read it, forbade that. So we filed and asked FERC to turn that off per their order, and so that's that second bullet. FERC has not addressed these two and provided us with approvals or disapprovals as of yet. We also had a second filing in January of 2013 on interregional aspects with our neighbors. Neighboring Southwest Power Pool, SPP, PJM is basically, we've started out Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Massachusetts, and then mapped to our west. So we've been working on interregional things. Another major issue that MISO's involved with is EPA, the coming EPA rules. They're going to have a very big impact on all of the gas or all of the coal plants in the whole country, including the coal plants in MISO's territory. We're doing quarterly surveys with all of our generators on their plans for complying with the EPA rules, and this is the latest information that we have. It's going to impact 295 units on the MISO footprint, 56 of which they are already retrofitted or have done what they need to do, so they don't need to do anything to comply with the new EPA rules. That leaves 239. 100 of the units have identified and told us that they will need to do retrofits for more controls. 76 units have told us that they probably will shut the unit down because it's not economic to put retrofits in. That may well mean that what they will do is change them out to gas plants on the same footprint, on their same site of the plant. And then 63 plants we have not heard from yet. That is not to say they're not working on things. They just haven't formally told us what their plans are.
I'm going to pause you at that slide for a minute because we have a bunch of students who came in who I think have a special interest in coal and what's after coal.
Okay.
And I'll give them a minute to kind of take in the information on the slide. And Representative Beard has some special guests that he would like to introduce.
Yes, Madam Chair. Thank you. One of the fun parts of being a state legislator and is the interesting and amazing people you meet from all over the place. And I have a friend of mine who's in the audience today. Mr. Jamal Ali Hussein is running for president of a country called Somaliland. And he is here today with us with some of his aides. One of the things they're looking at is our amazing grid and how it keeps us warm and lit and industriously prosperous. And so they're taking in this presentation today because it's of particular interest as they continue to grow and build their economy and their country in Somaliland. So, Mr. Hussein, welcome.
And for the students who are here, this might seem a bit dry, but this particular system that we're learning about as members of the committee is something that's critical for us to understand as we try to make new energy policy going forward. So this slide, I think, is fascinating because this, to me, says something about the turning point where we are in American energy policy as we maybe turn away from so much reliance on coal towards a more diverse resource base. But I'll let you go on, and then we'll do questions.
And thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Beard. I think that is very true. I think what you've said is very true. The EPA rules are a game changer through the whole country for coal plants. We have a lot of coal resources in the country, but the EPA rules are now making it very apparent that much more work has to be done to harness the emissions and impacts of the coal in order for it to be used. And that's what the generator owners are doing right now, is really studying that and to see, you know, for their individual plants, is it worth it to retrofit with the latest technologies, or is it better just to shut that plant down and look at using that property for another type of fuel generation. So thank you, Madam Chair. That's very true. What you said was very true. There also, I just wanted to put this slide in just because it's a good reference. The EPA compliance is on a tight time frame, really, when it comes to building big facilities. Compliance deadline is basically in 2015, towards the end. There is an ability for a one-year extension, and it's my understanding that EPA is allowing the state pollution control agencies, PCA in Minnesota, to provide the one-year extension. Where they think it's feasible, that doesn't say it's automatic, but they need to apply for it and give justification for getting it. But after that, it's pretty much everyone has to be in compliance, and that's a pretty tight time frame for doing the major construction that it would do for a retrofit or building a new gas plant. So I just wanted to give you that information so you had that.
Representative Beard.
I'm looking for a definition that will help us. The GWs, Mario, is that gigawatts or, because I know this was on the other page too, GWs impacted and then here under the work. But help us know what GW means.
Ms. Light. Sorry about that. Madam Chair, Representative Beard, that is gigawatts. Absolutely. That's 1,000 megawatts. What is it? 10 million. 10 million watts.
1 billion.
1 billion. Thank you.
1 billion watts.
Ms. White, on the far left hand side, then those are the different control technologies.
Correct.
The kid's got the joke.
Go ahead and proceed.
The important thing to look at with the different types of technologies is. The bars show you the usual time frames there is to install these, and you will note that the bars go beyond the compliance dates. So that's why everyone is working very hard right now to take whatever steps that they can take to make sure they're compliant when they should be compliant. So this is just this slide is more informational than anything else. And to just give you an idea about the facilities in MISO's footprint and where they're at right now. Another part of the EPA rules is we're anticipating that a lot of the coal plants will be retrofitted to natural gas. As you've heard, there's a lot of natural gas in the country supply-wise. We're not worried about the supply. What we're worried about is the fact that we only have so many pipelines. And the pipelines are basically full, used as capacity. So if we add a whole lot more gas plants, will there be enough pipeline capacity to provide the gas for these plants, especially during winter peaks? And MISO actually peaks in the wintertime at approximately 80 to 90% of their summer peak because we are in the Northland. And people use electricity in the wintertime for furnaces and heating just like natural gas. And we do understand that when we have an electric peak in the wintertime, that's the same time as the natural gas peak. So we are very concerned about that. We are actively talking to the natural gas industry and the pipeline industry about that, and we're learning about each other's industries. We have already identified a number of issues that we're working on. I list there, and so we're in the process of working actively on that as well. Entergy, I mentioned a while back, that's that big utility from Arkansas down to Louisiana. They are on track to join in December of 2013. There's a whole number of different aspects of that going on, including the state's public utility commissions from those states are working actively with MISO's or states, the organization of MISO states, are all actively looking at what this new enterprise of MISO, including the Entergy states, will look like, impacts to all of the states. And so there's a lot of work being carried on with that. This is actually just a repeat of things that I've mentioned, but I wanted to put it all on one slide for you, just so you had it. And that is what I have for you today. If you have any questions or if you would like a tour of our control center, just let me know. I'd be happy to put that together. Or anything else that you would like, just contact me at any time. And I thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you. If I could have you go back to that one slide with the control technologies on it. I don't know if you can go back. It's like maybe three slides. Kara was thinking this would be deeply meaningful for the students in the audience because when I was in 10th grade, I was on the debate team, and we had to debate about how to get rid of acid rain and the different control technologies. So I saw this slide about the activated carbon injection. I'm thinking they're all really engaged because they're familiar with these different control technologies. And then I realized probably they're not debating how to get rid of acid rain anymore in their 10th grade debate. But so that maybe wasn't the most interesting slide to pause on for the students, but that shows how old I am. Representative Groffalo, you had a question.
I'm surprised they had acid rain back then when you were a kid, Madam Chair. So, because I'm like, what, a year older than you, right?
Well, I bring it up because...
Who are these kids, by the way?
We figured out at the time how to control for acid rain. It was a problem that people didn't think was so easily surmountable, and yet the control technology... Once we said we needed to take care of this problem, we need to get rid of it, the technology was developed, and we took care of that problem, and we got rid of it. So I'm very confident that this generation and this generation can do some things with the current set of problems we have because we've seen it happen before in the past. But Mr. Representative Groffalo, I don't know. They're from all over. They're with a youth group called, it's YEA. I don't know what YEA stands for. Can somebody yell that out?
Youth Environmental Activists of Minnesota.
Youth Environmental Activists of Minnesota. And they had some training at the university yesterday from noon till 6, and they are here lobbying at the state capitol today. And I know this Representative Groffalo because I'm on their email list. I'm not young enough to be on their email list, but I'm on their email list.
Question for the testifier, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
On page 14 and 15 of your presentation, at least that's how they're labeled in our document.
Sure.
Actually, it's probably going to be the primarily on page 15 and 16. My apologies. Can you just can you elaborate a little bit on this on the pricing system? And I understand that. There's two different components here, but can you just elaborate a little bit more and give members a little bit more of a deep understanding of how this process works, of how bid and asks are matched with each other, and how they respond to current events or in the event of an unexpected event, how that market is able to respond?
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, certainly. What will happen is the day before, the morning before, the generators will inventory their generation fleet, their generators that are online and operating, and they will have, let's say they have a gas plant and they have 5 wind turbines and a coal plant, just for illustrations. And the they are, and so what they do is they take a look at the weather. For the wind turbines, they take a look at the wind, and they have probably they not only look at NOAA for weather, but they probably have purchased subscriptions to scientific weather forecasting services. And so they look at the temperature and they look at the wind speeds for the next day, and they decide that they will probably be able to sell 100 megawatts that day. They'll probably are 100 the energy equivalent of 100 megawatts from their coal plant and 50 megawatts from their gas plant. I'm making these numbers up, of course, and they'll be able to sell 10 megawatts from their wind generators based upon what they forecast the wind will be that day. They take this 160, so what they do is they call MISO and say, okay, it's a day-ahead market. For the day-ahead market, I want to offer my coal in at 100 megawatts, my gas in at 50 megawatts, and my wind, I think, will be online solid for 10 megawatts for the next day. And so for the coal, I'll offer it in at, I don't know, $2 a megawatt. I don't know what it is, but we'll just say that. You know, then the gas will offer it in at $3 a megawatt, and the wind will offer it in at $1 a megawatt. Okay, so they've set this up. And that's what they get. That's the information that they will give to MISO for the day ahead, and that's what they'll offer into the market. And then Xcel Energy will go into the market, and they'll look at this generator's cost and energy available, along with everyone else who's offered in whatever they offer at whatever price they offer, and then they will decide they're going to buy, 75 megawatts at some price and 50 megawatts at some price, and they look at how they're doing with their RES in Minnesota, and they think, oh well, we could buy 5 megawatts, and that would help with our RES in Minnesota. So they will specify they want to buy 5 megawatts of wind. So that will be all cleared in the market on this is the day ahead yet. So MISO will do all that paperwork and set all that up, the selling and the buying. And then the next day, the weather changes. And it changes like by 20 degrees, which means that usage goes higher. So Xcel needs to buy a little bit more energy. And because Xcel and everybody else needs to buy a little bit more energy, the generator thinks, well, you know, I could hike up that gas plant, and instead of 50 megawatts, I could probably sell 60 megawatts. So I'll offer in another 10 megawatts of gas, and then Xcel will go into the market and see what else is not yet purchased, and then go ahead and purchase from that market. And then again, MISO will take those, what's offered into the market, what's purchased from the market, and they will do all the paperwork to make sure that happens.
So, Madam Chair.
Representative Graffalo, it sounds like buying Doritos for teenage boys, but yeah. Representative Graffalo.
And so when they're buying these contracts, is it at a guaranteed rate of usage over a duration of time, or is it a cumulative amount of energy that is being purchased? Which I'm just trying, because obviously the total amount of energy could be distributed throughout the day.
Ms. White.
They had enough. They're outraged.
Yeah.
I think they went over the edge here.
So when they buy, the question was, do they buy it for a certain amount of energy throughout the day, or do they just buy a cumulative amount of energy for a certain time period?
I think they buy a certain amount of energy. I think it can fluctuate over the day, and I'm getting to the end of my specific information, so I might look around the room and see if anyone's got any more information, or I can find out more information for you. I think it can be set up that it can fluctuate, like at 9 o'clock in the morning, it can be one number at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. It can be another number at 4 o'clock when maybe they peak. It can be another number.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Graffalo.
My final question then. So then, the real time market, which is on the next slide on page 16. So this is where, for lack of a better word, there's a response to a crisis. If things are a lot hotter, more people are using more, or there's supply disruptions. Is this right where we see the market sort of correct itself?
Correct. That's exactly what happens. Okay. And it happens in real time.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And let me just suggest that if we get an opportunity to tour the MISO facility, we take that opportunity. It is a fascinating place to watch them operate the machinery of the grid. Ms. White, two questions for you. First of all, the easy one: generation on chart number one. You have your market and reliability footprint. You talk about generation capacity. Is that everything? Is that nameplate capacity of the wind farms too, or is that just the base load and peaking plants that are in the mix?
Ms. White,
you see, you got generation capacity there.
Yes.
What does that include when you put that in your inventory list?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I believe that's nameplate capacity, but I need to check back because we also have what we call intermittent firm capacity for specifically for wind plants, and what based upon the studied capacity of the turbine. Like on Buffalo Ridge, yeah. The capacity is very good. In other parts of the MISO service territory, it's not so good. The owners of the wind plants can claim that a certain percentage of their nameplate capacity based upon their wind resources can be counted on as dispatchable capacity. And that's actually a benefit for them because they make more money that way. But I do believe for this aspect, it may be nameplate, but I will check and I will get back to you on that.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. White, that would be helpful.
Sure.
Whenever the wind blows, though, I know you help the grid accommodate the vagaries of political will. One of the things we require is that they have to buy wind. So when wind blows, do you make sure that gets dispatched or put onto the grid and other things are dialed back? I know the answer. So tell us how you decide what gets dialed back, given that there are contracts out there and people wanting to do buy sells, and all of a sudden we're having a great day for wind production, and how do you make that work?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Beard. It happens because wind energy is very cheap because it has no fuel. It doesn't burn anything to be created. So it's a very low-cost energy. So when they offer the energy from a wind turbine into the market, it's offered at a very competitive price. And so, therefore, it's likely picked up way before other fueled energies are purchased. So what happens when we have a really good wind day? The gas plants back off because it's easy to turn down a gas plant because they can turn up and turn down really quickly. That's one of the beauties of having a gas plant, actually. And actually, if the wind is really, really strong that day, some of the coal plants have in the past been able to back down a little bit. Although it's much tougher for these baseline plants to have to back down, but they have done it to allow the wind on the system.
Follow up.
Just a follow up comment, because this obviously needs to be drilled down into a lot more deeply if we're going to be monkeying with the renewable energy standard. Because the cost of the wind is something we'll have to explore more that we can't do in the next 3 minutes. But that is...
We do have one more member question.
Yeah, and you do. So let me just make a quick comment, Madam Chair, because I was here for the SOX and NOx wars when we were going to save the planet from acid rain. And that was different than what we're facing now because everyone agreed that there was something we could identify and there actually was available technology to make things happen, to fix stuff. And that was generally agreed upon as well. Identifiable technology could be installed that actually had an outcome everyone could measure rather immediately. So they developed the cap and trade system to trade carbon or to trade sulfur and nitrogen credits. Some point in the future, I'll find in my report by the two gentlemen, the economists who actually developed and authored the cap and trade system, and why they agreed that worked for something as finite and recognizable as nitrogen and sulfur. But why it does not work for carbon dioxide, because I know where you're going with that discussion. I'm looking forward to having it with you.
I do recall, thank you, Representative Beard. I do recall, though, from 10th grade that the opponents to doing something about it were to argue the point that it was too expensive and that it was not worth doing the mitigation. So it was a similar conversation. I look forward to getting into more depth. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess just a comment to that is, we do have the technology to go and address putting massive amounts of carbon in the atmosphere, too, but it's a question of whether or not we have the will to do what we need to do. For Ms. White and the generation capacity here, does that include non-spinning reserves? Your number there indicates.
What's a non-spinning?
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, Representative, it does. Some of them. It depends how fast they can start spinning, and when I mean spinning, how fast they can turn on and be used.
It's a non-spinning reserve. I'm sorry. Am I the only one who doesn't know?
It's the plant that's turned off.
Thank you.
Yes. Completely.
Just say that.
Turned off completely.
Representative Garofalo, that's another tour we should go on. We should go to a coal-fired power plant and see when things spin and they're not hooked up to transmit power over the... But Representative Falk has a floor. Falk.
Thank you for that, Claire. And I know that some of the smaller, sometimes diesel or plants that municipalities have are not considered spinning reserves, and they don't go into the calculations for reliability as the spinning reserves do. And I guess maybe just to help people understand, maybe I missed this, I apologize if that was the case, but as I understand, all transmission, basically all load has to compete for all generation, and so MISO has kind of become a wholesale pricing mechanism, and sometimes that relationship isn't totally understood, so maybe you could speak to that a little bit.
Ms. White.
Whereas people are bidding, you know, what energy and at what prices, and then people are, who need to supply load are then, you know, going through that auction place to go and supply that load.
Ms. White.
Madam Chair, Representative Falk, you actually just explained it very well, I think. We are basically the market clearinghouse that everyone offers in their generation, and then it's purchased. Whatever's offered in is the pool of generation to be purchased, or the pool of energy to be purchased, and then it's purchased from that pool at whatever price that it's offered in. I'm not sure that you wanted anything more than that, because you did a good job of explaining it.
Oh.
Okay, members, we have about 30 seconds left. I'm just going to announce that a quorum is present. Representative Morgan, have you read the minutes?
Madam Chair, I have, and I would like to move the minutes from Monday, February 18, and Tuesday, February 19.
All those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, please say no. The motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Members, we're at the expiration of our time, but please feel free to ask Ms. White any questions, and thank you so much for making your way here today and giving us this information. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and again, I apologize for being late.
No problem. We're adjourned.